You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of Michigan's many natural resources, one that might not leap to mind is wild rice. But there's a rich tradition of wild rice in our state, especially for Michigan's first people, the Anishinaabeg tribes, who call it manumen and who regard it as a sacred gift. European settlers all but wiped it out, but there's work afoot to restore and protect wild rice in Michigan. With us now is Barbara Barton, an endangered species biologist, whose book is Manumen, the Story of Wild Rice in Michigan. And we welcome Roger Labin with the Lac Vieux des Airs Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Roger, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here, to be along with my friend Barb.
It's great to be here, too.
Barb, I am betting that most of us didn't know, that rice has been grown in Michigan for how long?
Rice is a wild plant here, and so it's been here for probably thousands of years. And all my career as an endangered species biologist up until about 10 years ago, I didn't even know wild rice grew here, which I don't know how that happened. But yeah, most non-tribal people don't know that wild rice grows wild here. It's not farmed. It's not an agricultural crop here. It's wild.
Roger, tell us about that word, manumen. What does it mean?
Manumen in a translation means the good seed. And the good seed, it can be as a medicine up until the point when you're processing it, when you put fire to it, then it turns into a food. And it's become a staple food for the Three Fires Society.
So, yeah, I want to have you take us more deeply into just what manumen means to Native American communities in Michigan, because it certainly, you mentioned food, but I certainly hear cultural importance and spiritual importance.
Right. And my mentor, Naganosh, that was my uncle, he was telling me that to him, the wild rice beds were Gitagon Manitou, Garden of the Spirits, or Spirit Garden. And so that comes from the migration story. Prior to the colonizers, or the Westerners, as before they arrived and set foot on the East Coast, the Three Fires Society, which is Ottawa, Potawatomi, and Chippewa, formed the Madewin Society. And we were actually located up at the mouth of the St. Lawrence Seaway. And a woman had this dream that where she was standing on the back of a turtle, which symbolized an island. And she was facing that westward direction. So she went to the spiritual leaders and wanted an interpretation of that dream. And what became of that dream was the Creator gave the spiritual leaders the seven prophecies. So the first and the third prophecies are what very, very important to the Native American people, because the first prophecy said that we needed to move, because if we didn't move, we were going to be faced with death and destruction. And so the third prophecy says that we would move in that direction, and we needed to follow the cowrie shell, and we were to follow that to the land where the food that grows on the water. And it needs to be said that this area in the Great Lakes Basin is the only place that this manumen grows on Mother Earth. And the prophecy says that when we find this food that grows on the water, we will know we will be home. And so this wild rice has been a very, very important to who we are today. And so now we are very, very adamant about the restoration and bringing it back.
Before we get to the restoration, Barb, let's talk about what happened to the wild rice in Michigan. How abundant was it at its peak?
In Michigan, it was really abundant. We had vast rice beds at the mouths of some of our rivers as they outletted into the Great Lakes. Some of them were literally thousands of acres in size, which is hard for me to visualize today. Particularly in Lake Erie, the mouth of the River Raisin, up the Detroit River, up into Lake St. Clair, even up into Lake Huron. The city of Benton Harbor is actually built where a rice bed used to be. So most of those river mouths had rice beds.
And how did European settlers regard this plant?
As a nuisance most of the time. It was used somewhat for food in the early days in the fur trade era. People would trade with the Anishinaabeg people for rice. But for the most part, as colonization happened in the state, it was regarded as an impediment, especially to travel when people were trying to move upstream, like in the Saginaw River Valley. You'll read lots of accounts of folks getting stuck in the rice that's growing and choking off the river, as they would say, and they wouldn't be able to get their boats up through it.
So where do we stand today with how much wild rice is in our state?
We've lost all the large beds. We have one large bed remaining, many beds, but one large one that's about 700 acres in size at Tawas Lake. The other beds are very small. Usually, I think there's maybe a handful that are 100 acres, maybe 200 acres, but for the most part, they're just little patchy areas here and there in inland lakes and streams.
So what happened to get us from this great abundance to almost gone?
Well, there were two things that happened almost simultaneously. Well, actually, three things. In the early 1800s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had this plan to dredge all the rivers in order to allow for the transport of goods in and out of ports. So they didn't have any regard for the wild rice beds or any other marshes that were there. So they straightened and channelized and dredged and filled. With that came a lot of development along the shoreline of the rivers, particularly when you look at southeast Michigan. So you had a lot of pollutants then going in, a lot of sedimentation going out into the bay. Also, what happened at that in the 1800s, you had the logging era, and that did a tremendous amount of ecological devastation in terms of erosion, running logs down the rivers, which, of course, scoured and the mills that they built on the shoreline and the railroads that they put in through the marshes to move logs. There was a lot of impact there as well. Then you had, it went from there to, we had a malaria epidemic in the United States in the 1800s, and in Michigan, in particular, in the southern half of the Lower Peninsula. And so they were trying to drain all of the, quote, swamps in the state. They didn't know what caused malaria back in those days. Mm-hmm. They thought it was vapors or gas coming from something, and it was always related to marshes. But then in the late 1800s in Europe, they discovered that the mosquito was the vector. And it took a few years for that information to come to Michigan, but they realized that they had to be much more diligent and much more precise on how they drained water, because before they'd leave a little bit of puddles here or there, mm-hmm. didn't matter for malaria, but in their minds. But then they found out the mosquitoes could breed in little pools of water. So they really started making a concerted effort to make ditches wider and deeper, which those ditches are still here today when you drive around and see them.
And Roger, as this was all happening, what was that like from the tribal point of view when as you saw all of it, as the tribe saw all of this dredging and all of this going on, how did that hit the tribes?
They were actually, you know, mourning, because to us that Manuman has a spirit and that Manuman was crying for help. But at the same time, the U.S. government was trying to assimilate the Native Americans. So this was the time that, you know, boarding schools and a lot of other things, they were trying to put a lot of the Native Americans on reservations and trying to control them and take them away from the sites that were sacred. And currently, I'm not aware of any of the federally recognized tribes in Michigan that does not have one form of restoration effort going. There are various stages. Some are a little ahead of others, but it's that teaching and that importance and bringing that back to who we are, because Manuman is part of our identity of who we are.
And Barbara, as an endangered species biologist, give us a sense of where are the most successful restoration projects for Manuman in Michigan right now.
Nottawaseppe Huron Band has been doing a great job working on restoration of the state-threatened species, which is Zizania aquatica, or the river rice. They've been working on that for several years now, trying to bring it back to their reservation. Of course, Roger's tribe, with his uncle's work starting and Roger continuing and others in his tribe, they've been able to bring rice back to Lac Vieux d'Isere itself after it was wiped out pretty much by a dam that was put in the late 1800s for logging. MDOT also is incorporating wild rice into some of the wetland mitigation that they're doing. And there was a planting done at a site near Grand Rapids last year, and it seems like every seed sprouted. The rice bed is very lush. The plants are about 8 feet tall now. And so those are three examples of successful restoration. It takes multiple years of seeding, and there's a lot of pressure on restoration efforts, things that work against you. It's important to have the buy-in of people who live nearby. Most of the rice beds are located off of tribal lands, and a lot of people who don't understand Manoomin view it as a weed. So you want to get buy-in from people in the area so that they don't try to kill it off once it becomes established.
And in your book, Barbara, you talk about TEK, traditional ecological knowledge. What is it and how does it fit into this reclamation?
The traditional ecological knowledge is the knowledge that Roger and the other tribal folks hold. Generations and generations of experience, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years of experience living with the land and understanding how everything works together that the colonizing people don't have. We've been here a few hundred years and have a completely different relationship. Many have a completely different relationship with the land. So the traditional ecological knowledge has been gleaned from that close relationship, and the tribal folks have an understanding of the relationship, much more so than the non-tribal people.
There's a line in the foreword to your book, Barbara, that jumped out at me, and I'm going to read it. Wild rice seed is structurally designed to embed itself within a willing substrate. Similarly, there's something about the spirit of Manoomin that seems designed to embed itself within a willing soul. Mm-hmm. How have you felt that work in you?
It's a spiritual thing. It's the only way I can put it. The first time I went out into a rice bed, it just touched my heart. The spirit of the place, the beauty of the plant, the significance of it, knowing how important it is to the tribes, and that's why they're here today, because of Manoomin. It just really touched me in a deep place. And the other beings that live in the rice bed, you know, there's always eagles out when we're out ricing. There's usually ducks in the rice bed and dragonflies. And just the life that's teeming in these beds just really touches you. And everyone I know who's gone into a rice bed experiences the same thing. And you just want to protect it.
And Roger, as you hear someone who is not Native American feeling this, what does this say to you, this kind of cooperation in trying to reclaim Manoomin? What does that mean in a broader picture for Native communities in Michigan?
Well, I think that, you know, the sensitivity that the non-tribal people can have towards this sacred resource, and we consider it a gift from the Creator. And one of the things that, you know, in our TEK is that, you know, a lot of people, I believe, have the misconception even when they are, brought to, know what wild rice is. It's difficult for them to understand that wild rice is an annual plant and that each plant only has a one-year life cycle. And so that gets us into one of the things we can talk about later is one of the challenges in trying to reestablish a wild rice bed is trying to develop that seed bank. And so when Barb, I've shown Barb how, she can feel like us and how I feel towards that. But sometimes it can be like a two-edged sword is because some of the things that happen is that even though we do restore some things, the lack of regulations and a management plan on the resource can actually impact the success of any efforts to restore it.
So that sounds like something that you need to look to Lansing to, or where do you need to go, Barb, to be able to kind of clear the way for a successful restoration so that You could actually have enough wild rice to really harvest and really use, and you could feel confident about it.
One of the really fantastic things that's happened over the last couple of years that Roger and I used to talk about years ago, we dreamed of having a state wild rice team where you had the tribes and various agencies in state government and maybe even federal governmental agencies sitting at the table talking about Mnemonen and how we can best protect it and conserve it and bring it back in places where it's appropriate. And actually, 2 years ago, that happened. A state wild rice team formed. And they continue to this day working on legal questions, regulations. There's all kinds of subcommittees that are focused on different aspects of protecting the rice. And so I think because we have everyone at the table now, there's a lot of forward momentum, and people are working really, really hard to make it a priority.
And is there any being harvested to the point where people could buy it?
There are a couple lakes that people are harvesting on, maybe three or four places they're harvesting on, but it's a wild plant. And I always tell people that wild plants are not meant to be commodities. They're wild plants that are gifts from the Creator for us to eat, to feed our families or feed the elder or feed the community. The tribal folks, if they are harvesters, not everybody's a wild rice harvester. So up at Rogers Tribe, for instance, they can go out and harvest and get a good amount of rice, and then they might sell some of it to supplement their income. But we really don't have the big, vast rice beds like they have in Wisconsin or Minnesota where it can afford to be sold more. That's just my personal opinion about it.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to add to what Barb had said is that one of the things the Wild Rice Initiative is actually working towards is to try to bring the state of Michigan up with, like, Wisconsin and Minnesota, where in Minnesota, wild rice is actually designated as the state grain. And even though it's a grass, I mean, the Minnesota has so much respect for Mnemonen and plant and everything else. The state of Michigan needs to do that to enable them to do a lot of the other things to preserve and the things that the initiative is trying to do. So even to do inventory, to try to take an inventory. Like right now, one of the biggest influences or impacts on wild rice is because there is no status on it. And so it doesn't enable us to move forward to try to protect it. So there is a lot at stake to trying to make sure that we maintain this in Michigan.
It is a very fascinating and a rich story that I think many people had no idea, and thanks to you, we are much more informed. Roger LeBin with the Lac Vieux des Airs Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and Barbara Barton, whose book is Mnemonen, The Story of Wild Rice in Michigan. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Stateside's executive director is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.